outer space. The American people became greatly disturbed and alarmed. And since that time, considerable heart searching has taken place among our people. And one of the chief subjects of re-study, and one of the chief concerns of our people since that time has been, is our educational system adequate? Why are we lagging behind the Russians? And many answers and many conflicting answers have been offered. Some have given a blanket indictment of the whole system of American education. It is too easygoing, too many frills. The fundamentals are being neglected, and so forth. Some have maintained that not enough emphasis has been placed upon the scientific subjects in the curricula of our schools, and mathematics, and physics, technology. Others have held that insufficient attention has been paid to the especially gifted student. He is, as a rule, slowed down to the learning pace of the average student. And there is general agreement that we haven't enough schools for our expanding population and not enough qualified teachers, and that our teachers are inadequately paid. Now, this stock-taking is a very good thing. In fact, we should have such periodic examinations and re-examinations of this, our most important institution of our national life, our school system. We should have them periodically. And in fact, such critical examinations of our schools and their curricula and of our educational philosophy generally have taken place from time to time. The aims and methods of instruction have from time to time been subjected to searching analysis by outstanding educators. And from time to time, new theories of education have been advanced. New pedagogic techniques have been suggested. And some of them have been widely accepted and incorporated into our educational system. Others, after an experimental stage, having been found wanting, but after a time abandoned. Some 40 years ago, Professor John Dewey initiated a movement, a great movement, which proliferated in many directions, which called for a reorganization both of the philosophy of our education and of our techniques of education. And many types of what we used to call progressive education developed, where children were allowed to express their individuality with very little dictation on the part of the teacher. There have been all along those who have questioned the value of classical studies in our education and who have called for priority for vocational training and for the teaching of the sciences. And there has always been a sharp difference of opinion as to where the educational emphasis should be placed, on the child or on the community needs, whether the individual should be subordinated to the needs and the objectives of the state or society, whether the state and society should be reorganized in order to permit the greatest freedom and fullest development of the individual. And so what we are reaching out for today in this re-examination of our educational system is nothing new in American life, although it has become more urgent because a vast military problem has suddenly become involved. It's a question of political prestige or of national survival. And so there has been added an element of extreme urgency to this problem of the right kind of education which should be given to our children. Now, it is, of course, difficult to define exactly the objectives of education. Each generation would like to form and mold the next generation in its own image. But unfortunately, or fortunately, the images of no two generations are exactly alike. While, for example, there is general agreement on certain, what you might call constants in education, on certain timeless, desirable elements, the desiderata in education, which each succeeding generation would like to pass on, would like to see passed on from the preceding generation. There is nevertheless a very large, wide range of opinion as to what constitutes the total program of education. Because this involves the question of what constitutes the good life or the ideal man. And on that there are, as you may well imagine, sharp differences of opinion among individuals and among cultures and among generations of men. One of the wisest of all men, Plato, for example, said that the aim of education is to develop in the body and in the soul all the beauty and all the perfection of which they are capable. And that's a very attractive definition. The aim of education is to develop in the body and in the soul all the beauty and all the perfection of which they are capable. But does each age have the same conception and the same standards of what constitutes beauty and perfection? According to Plato, for example, the perfect man, his perfect man, would accept as normal and desirable slavery and war, and having all things in common, including wives and children. If you read Plato's Republic, his ideal society not only tolerates but accepts as desirable war and slavery and forms of communism. And I'm sure that Plato himself would shudder with horror at our modern conceptions of beauty, that our modern architecture, for example, or painting, or drama, or poetry, or writing in general. But if it is difficult to confine the wide horizons of education within the hard framework of one definition, I think it is not so difficult to agree in a general way on what we want education to do for our children. Speaking broadly, there are three ways of educating our children, and these three are, of course, interrelated. They are three parts of the whole. We can, in the first place, and we should, in the first place, educate them as persons, as human beings in relation to character. We can train our children to grow up, or we can fail to train our children to grow up, to be men and women of integrity, and honor, possessed of sound habits of industry, of high standards of craftsmanship, of self-control, of unselfishness. This is the type of education that a great psalm in the book of Psalms had in mind when it spoke of the ideal man as the man who has been trained to walk blamelessly, to do what is right, to speak the truth from his heart, not to slander with his tongue, and do no evil to his neighbor. We can educate our children or fail to educate them. In the first place, then, in a code of personal conduct, which will guide them in all their future relationships in life, as sons, as daughters, as husbands, as wives, as fathers, or mothers, or as friends. And all this has nothing to do with Sputniks and missiles and nuclear fission or space travel, with progress or with failure in our atomic laboratories. Nothing whatever to do with that. All this is centered in the laboratory of the human heart, where new discoveries are very rare indeed. It is not a changing and evolving scientific knowledge, but here is the accumulated wisdom of the human race. Of course, the recently developed sciences of psychology and psychiatry may help in the training of our children, or may set right in some instances what has been disturbed in their emotional or mental lives. But the moral objectives of this kind of training and education have been set long ago. The objectives for the training in character. They were known to the prophets and the seers and the sages of all times and of all the great religions of mankind. And this then is the first of the three ways. And in my judgment, this is the most important way of education, for it is the most directly related to the happiness of the human being. It is this that will either make him or destroy him, regardless of how much knowledge he accumulates or the position which he comes to occupy in the competitive society in which we live. This training in character will either make him or destroy him, will either yield him or deny him life's deepest satisfactions. Of mere learning and of mere study, the wise author of the book of Koheleth in the Bible said, "In much learning is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow very often." But of the good man, the man of character, of uprightness, the psalmist says, he is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither, and in all that he does he shall prosper. When you look about you in your community, and in your nation, you must realize, for example, that the increase in the unhappiness of our young generation, which expresses itself in so much of juvenile delinquency, is not due to the fact that we do not teach enough sciences in our schools. It is due, if one can put his finger on any reason for this frightening increase in the unhappiness of our young generation, to false standards, to a general breakdown clear down the line, principally in the home and principally in this continent of education, the education in character. Now, the second way of educating our children is, of course, for citizenship. Our children are all destined to spend their lives in a society, in a state. They will be influenced by their social and political environment, and in turn may influence it. Therefore, we must give our children a code not alone of personal conduct, but a supplementary code of social ethics. No man is complete in isolation. A man becomes complete only in a social environment, in a community. Those who are privileged to be born into citizenship in a free society, in a free country, must be trained, therefore, into the twofold responsibility, that of defending the free society and the free government, for they are constantly threatened. Even in peacetime, they are threatened. And in the second place, of participating in the life of the nation in such a way that evil conditions which may exist and endanger the freedom and the well-being of a people may be eliminated. No free society is ever perfect, and may be eliminated in ways which will not endanger the democratic structure. Eliminated through constitutional reform rather than through subversion. The free citizen, therefore, must be an enlightened citizen, a disciplined citizen, a responsible one. If we do not like external restraints, dictatorial controls over our lives, our collective lives, we must develop within ourselves self-restraints. We must learn voluntarily to subordinate our own selfish interests to the good of the community and make of ourselves ready and willing instruments of the collective good. Clean government, social justice, the elimination of economic insecurity and unemployment, the elimination of all forms of discrimination and group oppression, and the cultivation of goodwill and brotherhood, which are the cement of a free society. Freedom of thought and speech and action and the pursuit of happiness and the retention of human dignity. These are all precious values, of course, of which every generation of citizens and every citizen in every generation must be prepared to pay a price in terms of sincere performance of civic duties, in terms of waging relentless war on social and political evil and injustice and corruption, on special privilege, on the exploiters of a free society. A special price must be paid by those who want to enjoy human freedom, to see to it that the high standards are preserved, the high standards of a free society. So that the second way of educating our children is a deliberate education in citizenship, which somehow we take for granted, as though children will pick them out of the thin air by the very fact that they live in a free society. That is not at all the case. It requires deliberate training, education, information. And the third way of educating our children is the education of their mind, training for thinking. This is more important than training for any profession or any calling, whether one is educated in the sciences or in the humanities is not nearly as important as to whether one is educated to think. And as Justice Brandeis put it, there is no effort so taxing to the individual as to think, to analyze fundamentally. The hardest thing in the world to do is to think. And the greatest contribution that can be made to society is a new thought, an emancipating new thought. Our age, this nuclear, electronic, and space age, with its vast potentialities for good and evil, for survival or destruction, our age has become terribly involved and complex. No age was ever simple, but our age has become especially because of the very rapidity of the new revelations which have come to it and the new power which has been made available to it. A man's mind must keep pace with the new revelations and the new challenges and opportunities. And man's mind is capable of keeping pace if it is trained in the exacting disciplines of thought, if the new generation is trained in a new reverence for learning. If the human mind is not abused or misled by shoddy methods, by false propaganda. Why, today our most advanced sciences of psychology and all the social sciences are being employed to influence the processes of our thought, and therefore of our action, to influence them below the level of awareness. We have become the objects of what has been called the hidden persuaders. Those individuals and those techniques which seek to precondition us, to move us in a non-rational way, to make decisions, to channel us towards goals which others have set for us and for their own ends. Some of you, I'm sure, have read this very interesting book by Mr. Vance Packard on the hidden persuaders. You know what I'm speaking of. Mr. Packard has analyzed the work of this vast new army of professional public relations men and advertising agents and hidden persuaders who devise ways of playing upon the hidden weaknesses and frailties and anxieties and dread of nonconformity and the infantile hangovers of human beings. Of playing upon them in order to sell them certain products. $9,000 million are being spent annually on these professional stimulators and persuaders who very often persuade men and women to buy what they do not need, to spend what they haven't got, and to live beyond their means, and surround the very idea of possessing, of acquisitiveness, of material things, with a certain mystic glory, a halo, frequently accompanied by symphonic music and poetry. Now, this same technique of manipulating the human personality and human behavior for the purposes of selling automobiles or cosmetics or cigarettes is also employed to sell political ideas and social attitudes. Governments have gone into this business of hidden persuasion, of propaganda, in a big way, which does not exclude the big lie or the half-truth. Fascism and Nazism and communism develop the technique of patriotic lying, of brainwashing, of keeping unpalatable facts away from the people to a frightening degree. And when the human mind has not available dependable data upon which to base conclusions, it is floundering, it is helpless. The mind of man was never under such concentrated attack as it is today. It used to be the goal of education to help a man think. The goal of this pseudoscience is to subtly influence and direct the certain selfish ends, the processes of the human mind. And therefore, it is especially important in our generation to educate our children to think critically, analytically, to sift, to screen, to ask of every affirmation made in the public press, around the television, around the radio, and all the mass media of communication, to ask of every affirmation its credentials. And that's a terribly difficult thing to do. Someone has said, as soon as you can say what you think, and not what some other person has thought for you, you're on the way to being a remarkable man. And so here are the three ways of educating or of failing to educate our children. And some of it we must do ourselves, in our homes, by example, by precept, by the quality of the cooperative life we live in our homes. And I think, of course, the greatest and most important center of education is the home, not the school. Some we relegate to teachers and schools and in colleges and in churches. But we cannot leave all the education of our children to the schools. And we cannot shift to the shoulders of others the responsibilities which belong to parents in the education of their children. Some of this education we have to leave to friends, to the friends of our children. Some to the community environment, the social atmosphere, the cultural milieu, things which we cannot directly control. But I, for one, have always been of the opinion that if we do a good job in the home, we have laid strong and sure foundations in character for our children, which is the supreme good of education and the supreme good that we can do to our children. And so it is good that our people have begun to think more and more of this vast, highly involved problem of education. And that have begun to think more and more of these three ways. No one way is in and by itself sufficient. And those who tell you that what's wrong with America is that we don't have enough scientific training are telling you only a small, fragmentary part of the vast truth. This is not what will make America great or make American citizens happy. All of it must be done. Good training, whatever subject is taught, whether it's science or the humanities or physics or chemistry or economics or sociology or literature, every subject that is taught should be taught well. Children should be helped to think through what they're learning. Our children must also be trained in the desperately needed strategy of living in a free society, in the duties and the responsibilities of citizenship. And above all, our children should be helped to grow up and grow into the maturity of character. Character is the total man in action. And those who overlook this important element of character training are not preparing their children either for society, for citizenship, or for their own contented and satisfying lives.